you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What's up, fellow addicts? This is Shannon, the producer of the SDR show. On today's episode, Ralph Sutton and guest co-host Dave Landau are joined by the very talented musician Jason Beeler. He's formerly of the band Saigon Kick and has a great new album out that's perfect for these times called Songs for the Apocalypse. And if you hang out till the end of the episode, you will see him do a very special live performance on the show. Don't forget, we do the show live every single Wednesday and Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern at gasdigitalnetwork.com/live. You can watch that for free, but if you want the show 5 days sooner, want to hang out in the live chat, get the HD stream, and access to every single episode we've ever done and every other show on the Gas Digital Network, just go to gasdigitalnetwork.com and use promo code SDR. You'll get a 2-week free trial plus all the perks I just mentioned. Right now, here it is, the James Beeler episode of The SDR Show.
This is the intro to the shit show. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This is a hit show. Show me a tit show. Please, someone fuck the hoe. It's weed, I beat, it's hookers and blow. It's art, it's far, you need to know. The SDR Show. Let's go.
It is The SDR Show, sex, drugs, and rock and roll show. I am Ralph Sutton, back once again. Always happy to have Mr. Landau in with me. Dave, how are you, sir?
Good, man. How about you?
Good. I hit you up the other day and said very, very abruptly, put me on your show next week, you son of a bitch. And you are doing that. So I'll be on your show next week, which I'm excited.
Yes, next Wednesday.
Yeah, it's really nice. A couple of quick things off the top of the show. Follow us everywhere at the SDR show. Leave a 5-star review. Once a month, Shannon will pick a winner to get a free t-shirt. We picked one, I guess, last week, so we got a couple weeks to go. Shannon in purple with the purple light and the purple wallpaper or paint. How are you, darling?
Well, thanks. How are you?
You look chipper today for some reason.
I am more awake now. Full disclosure, we recorded earlier in the day, but earlier in the day isn't great for me camera-wise, so this is my hour.
All right, that's good. The twilight hours are good for you. Okay, so now we'll describe him as this. Great guitarist, singer, songwriter, has a brand new album out called Songs for the Apocalypse. I'm not even going to go into the whole title of everything. We'll get into it with him because I have some stories. It is Jason Beeler. How are you, buddy?
Man, I couldn't be doing any better. Thanks for having me.
So let me start with just telling you a couple things off the top. We don't know each other. We've never met, but I have a couple of quick things. Number one, because I haven't seen you in years, as far as like watching, looking for you, watching Saigon Kick videos, whatever, I decided to Google you. And the first image that comes up is a ripped you with really dumb tattoos all over your body.
Right.
That turns out to be not real. And what? I fell for
what?
It.
What is this blasphemy that you were
Shannon's going to show it to us. I 100% fell for this. And then Shannon said, no, that's not real. I'm like, oh, well, God damn it. It looked real to me.
Don't make me take my shirt off here.
I was
that
excited.
That was the Maroon 5 guy, wasn't it?
I don't think anybody has a tattoo that says nap time.
Don't take the show out of the biz.
I'm sorry. But...
So that's
you the guys that go and like heckle the magician. Like,
just
you didn't really pull the rabbit.
I felt so stupid. Once I looked at some other pictures, I'm like, oh, I'm just an idiot. I was like, that dude's about my age. Look how ripped he is. But no, I'm an idiot. So that's number one.
Well, first of all, I am that ripped, but I don't have any tattoos.
Okay, fair enough.
Second of all, the best thing about the internet is like my guy who does all the artwork for me does these Photoshops constantly.
I saw a bunch of them on your Instagram.
He did one of me on George Costanza, The Art of Seduction. And the best thing about the internet is I got this lovely like message from this woman who was like, I just want to say, I think it's so amazing that at your age and a man of your size, you would be so body positive. Cause I think a lot of us need that kind of hero. And I was like, this is what the internet
that is great. So then it leads to the second part of the story. So I, again, don't know you, right? But years ago, I had a radio show that was on a bunch of stations. The other part of your former bandmates were touring sans you, right? Correct. Saigon Kick did a tour, sans you. I don't know what year this is. Let's make up a year and say it was like 2003 or something. I don't
know. It was known as the Great Kerfuffle of 2003, yeah, I believe.
Something like that. Is that about right around that time, I think, if I had a guess? I don't remember.
I wasn't there. I can't remember.
So, of course, I'm assuming at the time, relations were not that good. So,
relations have never been good.
That so I know. We'll get into that as well. Okay. And they shit on you on and off air. Okay. So, let's just say that 20 years ago, almost at this point, whatever. Well, putting that in column A for this story.
Sure.
Column B, it comes out. I hear the new record. I heard the song with Latour from Queensryche and loved it. And awesome. Like, oh my God, it sounds like modernized Saigon Kick. Fucking super excited. Let's get this guy on. And I email back and forth with your manager or whoever it was from the label, whatever, maybe. I don't know who it was. And they said, press person. And they said, I'd love you to perform live. And then the response was, all of your guitars,
yes,
all of them, mm-hmm, are at the shop. And I started thinking to myself, this fucking guy, I guess it's true. This what guitarist has every guitar to go to the shop at once so that you don't have anything to play in the house?
Now, before you join the ranks of the other Saigon Kick members by singing, saying horrible things about me, I will explain that to you now. This is my main acoustic guitar that I use, okay, for all the acoustic things I do. And because I tune it a certain way, I figured I would take the break over the holidays and have this piece slightly moved back so it could be in these different tunings.
Okay.
To which 2 days later, you emailed and said, hey, would you do some acoustic stuff on the radio? So, and I was like, my guitar that I do all my, not my electric guitars.
All right. Okay. Fair enough.
My acoustic guitar was actually being fixed. Right. And I was like, here goes the guy's going to be like, yeah, your guitar is gone.
Right. That's exactly what I was like. Oh, God, these guys are right. And then
there's three on the wall behind him. Yeah, so it's hard exactly to believe that.
Well, those are electrics, though. I can't do an acoustic number.
Right, right.
Right. I get it. But
nice, though. Yeah. Got Telecaster, I see.
Whoa, look at Dave naming shit off the top of it.
Yeah, head. I tried to play when I was in middle school for a long time. I don't have the talent. I envy you.
The good news is then I said like, today and yesterday, getting prepped for this, I watched a few interviews of yours. And I'm like, oh, no, this dude's actually likable. And so I assumed right away that I misread the whole situation, even before this interview, that you were going to be a pretty normal guy.
That's a lot of pressure. Yeah, I mean, I've always found myself delightful. I can't speak for everybody else.
Right. I never met you, so I can't say. I'm just saying, so that's the story. So I want to start in the history just because, and then we'll get into the new stuff.
Is this going to be a thing where you're actually going to make an insinuation that a band didn't get along and said nasty things about each other?
Yeah, I know.
It's crazy. I don't buy it.
Hard to believe.
Where are we going with this?
Yeah, this is really breaking new ground. It's a real hot take on the internet right now. And I want to tell you, so like, I've always been a big fan, right? Not just from the first and second album, but even I followed Saigon when the rest of it was you. And I'll tell you the story. Big Shot, your cover, which I think was on maybe the last album of Saigon, is Bastards, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I was a strip club DJ, and that cover of the Billy Joel Big Shot, so I would play every time I worked at a new strip club. It was one of my first songs because everybody was like, oh my God, where the fuck did you get that? Like, it was like such a perfect song for a strip club because every guy there wanted to be a big shot. You know, it just worked out perfectly. And then my super gay story, I was dating this girl, and boy, Dave, I think he's going to love this too. I was dating this girl for about 4 months, and she said that what she hated about me, and is a big thing with me, I don't say I love you to a girl. I just don't. Unless I really, really believe it, I won't do it, right?
And so you've never done it?
No, really never. Not in 15 years, maybe. So finally, I felt with this girl, I was ready to admit it. And I played her, I sent her via a CD that I burned, fucking I Love You by Saigon Kick.
One of the heaviest tracks ever.
It's such a beautiful song, though. And literally, we broke up a week later. So I blame you again.
That's what happens. I mean, I'm telling you right now, this is going to do bad things for you long term. I mean, it always starts off lovely.
He helped you out. Yeah. It wasn't going to work.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, well, I apologize for that horrible end to that relationship.
Yeah. Well, fairy, you know, tale. It is a beautiful song, though. And then I don't want to spend too much time on old school days, but
I don't mind. It's fun.
what the fuck does Saigon Kick even mean? Let's start with that.
Seriously, we were in a rehearsal room trying to come up with a name, as a band does, and you can already tell how good we got along. Yeah. So the conversation was really pleasant. And someone said something like along the lines of Saigon. I think someone quoted I think there was a Cult song called Saigon Kiss.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, or a lyric. And someone else misheard it as Saigon Kick. And it wasn't that we all went like, that's the greatest name. It was the only name that we all would not quit over.
Okay.
Like, we were like, whatever, fine. We kind of had that kind of a feel to it. So that's really the very interesting, extremely intellectual reason.
You know, a band is off to a good start when they all go like, yeah, whatever, fine. Let's just do that.
I won't quit if we call it that. Was the big vote of approval.
I was just hoping it was Saigon Whore, somehow related to Chris Farley and Dirty Work. And that's what you misheard. You were like, that's it. How did you guys meet then? Like, it always seems like with band, like, talent gravitates to each other, but then they don't like each other's personalities so often.
We had the second part. the first part of that conversation was really that at the time in Miami, there was a really big hair metal scene. And I don't mean hair metal derogatory. I mean, those bands were great and I love them. And I don't know what else to call it, because that's
right. It is a genre.
Wait, and you have the glam influence.
I mean, I loved a lot of that stuff, but I also really at that time was not, you know, if I would have been a hot blonde guy with abs and stretch pants, I would have been jumping all over the place. And I'm not
according to the internet photo, you are.
Well, now later in and life, I'm a late bloomer like Colonel Sanders. So that we really didn't fit in with that. So it was really the four of us were really couldn't get in any other band. Mm-hmm. So much like the way we named the band, it was kind of like, well, whatever. If you're the only drummer, the guitar player, bass player, and singer we can find. I mean, the only guy, all those cool bands that were doing really well at the time would have nothing to do with us.
Yeah, because you were a band that, I mean, the sound of Saigon was definitely not a hair band. It felt more
metal. I don't know,
Jane's Addiction-y. Like, it didn't feel like, or Cult even like that. It's a good example. Like a band that wasn't, maybe the Cult would take out a hair band to open for them, but they were not a hair band, you know? So that I always thought that that's what Saigon was.
Jane's Addiction was a life-changing show for me, like life-changing. Cause that was the first time I heard I always liked heavy music, but I was never really much of I got a hot chick in a super fast car. Wow. Like that just wasn't my thing.
I mean, write that song right now. Cause I'm already into it.
I know. It's publishing, by the way. now we're going to break up over publishing just like every day. but so anyway, that when I saw Jane's Addiction, it was like this heavy tribal, and they weren't singing about, you know, non-goofy stuff. So it connected for me. So that was a big part of it. And at the same time, I was always a massive fan of like the Beatles and Queen and that melodic stuff. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's kind of where we were aiming. And when we first came out, we actually did toured with like the Ramones. We did shows with Faith No More.
Yeah, Faith No More is another one that makes sense. I could see that totally.
And then, but I always loved all kinds of music. So literally to this day on my playlist, I have Barry Manilow and Meshuggah side by, like, I don't care. I'm just into good tunes. Right. So there was Ballad on the first record. There was Diversity on the first record. We didn't have a hit, so it wasn't a curse. Mm-hmm. Second record comes along, and we were in Mexico actually shooting a video for Hostile Youth, I think, off that record. Strangely enough, with the guy who directed the Gift documentary for Jane's Addiction. And I get a call from Doug Morris going, hey, you know, this radio station in South Florida just started playing the Ballad and it is exploding. And not being the most brilliant guy, but I was smart enough to go, probably not the best time with Nevermind just hitting.
Right.
So 90, we really had 91. The Ballad that I really feel responsible. Like, we killed hair metal. It was the last Ballad of that group, which in many ways makes me the guy who invented grunge, if you think about it.
I'll take it that way. It's funny. Also, a friend of the show, the guy that was in Tough, Stevie Rochelle.
Oh, yeah.
He said that his song was number one in Dial MTV the day that Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit debuted on MTV. It was the last hair band to be on the top.
He's trying to steal my thunder now?
Yeah, he's trying to steal your thunder. I'm just ruining your stories left and right. It's also,
it's
by
not
the way,
true.
I think he ruined hair metal. I'm going to stick with it.
That's fine. I know.
You're welcome.
I put all those people out of work. That's why I'm so confident.
It's also
it is incredible, though, that, yeah, you were right there on the cusp. Did you want to write stuff like that, or did you just write whatever?
I always write whatever I want to write, for better or for worse. Not because I'm some brave, bold. It's like, to me, I always loved music. So, like, when I grew up, I listened to the Fifth Dimension, the Beatles, AM Gold. Then I got into Ozzy and all this stuff. And I just love Miles Davis. You know, it doesn't Bjork, Tom Waits. I'm just into music. So that's the way I always hear music. So whatever I feel like doing in that moment, whether it's something kind of heavy or something more melodic or a ballad or whatever, that's the way I've always written. So in many ways, the kind of way I do stuff makes more sense now, I think, to a lot of people than it did then, because people don't care anymore. Most people just listen to whatever they want to hear. So if it's Lizzo, Metallica, the Pantera song, whatever game they're at, they just want to hear good tunes. So hopefully, I think people have changed that. Because when we were kids, not dating you by any chance.
Well, but, same age.
You know, you'd be at the punk table at school, or the metal table, or the new wave table, and you'd fight over, you know, Iron Maiden is the best. And there'd be
my table was known as the Sissy Mary table.
Right.
I wish my school was that cool.
But I mean, that's the way it was. Definitely like a John Hughes thing when I was growing up.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. It was. And then there was no, I mean, MTV, even at the time, even once they started to blossom, they would segment. It was MTV Rock, MTV, Yo MTV Raps. They would separate. Every radio station would separate. So by nature, in school, we would separate. And rock, especially, is one of those genres where you took your genre seriously. If you were really into Bon Jovi, you couldn't hang out with the Testament guys because they looked at you as like you liking the wrong kind of music.
The funny thing is, too, is I've gotten to know like so many of these guys over the years, and like I can't tell you how many Neil Diamond and Barry Manilow fans and some of the heaviest fans that you think these guys are all metalheads, and you go home and they're playing like Barbra Streisand records.
Right, I mean, imagine, a musician should be.
And dressing up funny, but I shouldn't say that because it's not my story to tell.
Yeah, I imagine you were raised on everything from what? Motown to the Beatles to all kinds of soul music always seems to be that thing too, like Otis Redding all that always seems to be an across the board thing with almost every genre of music.
Yeah, I just remember being in the backseat of the car with my parents going somewhere out on Long Island and like whatever was on the radio, it was AM.
Like Sam Cooke or something. Yeah.
Oh, Sam Cooke. I still listen
to Sam Cooke all the time.
Dude,
oh my
he's
God.
So good, man.
Yeah such a great artist.
That there is no other voice. Since.
My two favorites, Sam Cooke and Bill Withers, I listen to all the time.
I thought you were going
to
say me and Sam Cooke, but okay.
Yeah, well, yeah, I put you in the same category.
We're going to go in that direction. So it's fine.
All I have three, have Jason, build. Sam, and Bill Withers. Bill Withers is amazing, too. Yeah. That guy
by the way, if you never saw his documentary, see the documentary called Still Bill. It's phenomenal. It really is a great documentary.
He's the guy who just went for it.
Yeah,
at 30-something.
It's crazy. It's worth watching if you've never seen it. It's great. And then Corey Glover, a friend of the show from Living Color, makes an appearance at the end of the documentary, which is great. Just to put a button on Saigon, February will be 30 years from the first record. And there's a rumor, which maybe is not true, that a new Saigon Kick record is coming out this year. Is there any truth to that? Or maybe they're doing it behind your back again?
If they're doing it behind my back, that's highly probable. But it doesn't involve me. I wish them tremendous success.
Okay, fair enough. So you don't talk to any of them anymore?
No, that's not true. I mean, I speak to Chris on occasion. I've had dialogue with Phil from time to time. Matt and I are not on speaking terms.
Right.
And,
Phil came out with his dildo, did you buy one so that you could, play with it?
I was the beta tester, yes. So, okay. As any band member is, you wind up being inserted by the other band member at some point, whether it's plastic or otherwise.
Fair enough. Yeah, Dave, I don't know if you know this, but his former drummer, Phil Verone, I don't know if he still is, but for a while, he got very into the porn industry and was putting out his own penis as a dildo.
That's a lot of confidence.
Which is so unlike a drummer, first of all.
Right.
And
so
second
strange.
Of all, it makes it wonderful when you go to the PTA meeting and the other parents don't know which is who, and they just kind of make the reference of, that's the guy.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's good. That was probably.
Yeah, that's got to be nice. All your work comes down to somebody making a dildo. Jesus, is that cool?
All right. So now let's move into today, the new album that is Songs for the Apocalypse.
I found it.
Oh, let's see it. Let's see it. Let's take a look at his hog. That's weird. It's not that impressive, to be honest. Shannon, you would be the one that would say, is that an impressive penis?
I I can't tell the size of it from this picture. I would need something to scale it next to.
Do you like also, a Prince Albert?
It is a Prince Albert in it, which I've never seen before in a dildo.
I've never seen one in real life, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it takes a lot of confidence. I agree. I bet you, Jason, when you started this interview, the last thing you thought you'd be doing would be staring at Phil's penis.
No, I have a timer, and I was seeing how long it would take you to get me there.
Okay. By the way, Shannon, for scale, that's why I keep this here for all my dick pics, because it's a Tabasco bottle, and then people think, oh, my God, look at his penis.
That's why I have this giant microphone.
So now...
Wait a minute. I don't even have any microphone. This is terrible.
So... There's a lot going on here with this record. It's Jason Bieler and the Baron von Bielski Orchestra.
Sure.
Is that right?
Sure. If you get it right, you get a Samsung toaster. So I was kind of counting on you to.
No. Well, first of all, I didn't even realize Samsung made toasters anymore.
I want one.
It's a signature model. Unlike Phil, I went a different direction.
So
it's also a feel good, but it's just it makes toast.
Yeah.
It's more focused on baked goods.
Yeah,
it'll warm you up in a different area.
It's FILL.
It's a whole different Pop Tart thing.
And the description on the website, I'm going to read this verbatim: a post-apocalyptic troubadour with a penchant for the sonically grotesque. So there's a big theme, circus kind of morbidity going on here. Correct.
Sure.
I don't like that answer. I feel like I misfired.
No. I mean, to a certain degree, I don't think it's a concept record in the classic sense of the records. Like we talk about like The Wall,
right,
where it's a linear story, but there is this definite underpinning, if you will, of a vaudeville-esque sea level carnival with rusty sharp objects left out for the kids to play on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could take a left, you can kind of make your own adventure picture book kind of, theme. So anywhere you jump in, you can jump in and kind of get it. But I think if you sit back and have that kind of time and want to ingest it as a whole, it should.
There's
make.
No linear stories where it's not like an Operation Mind Crime or a Wall where you need to follow along to get the full story. But there's a theme overriding the whole record.
But if you play the record backwards, it does say Paul is dead like 75 times.
Wow. That's amazing. Wow. That you're able to sneak that in. So one of the things that is really
a lot
amazing,
of Beatles things happening, really.
You've got a lot of great collaborations on this record, right? So we'll start with Jeff Scott Soto's on there, old school rock and roll dude. And I'd like to hear this story because I do my research, Jason, and it says that he was the one that gave you your first job in music.
Correct.
What does that mean?
Well, when I was... 17 or 18, I wound up playing on someone's demo tape, or there was some jam thing we went and recorded. And the bass player from that project heard that Jeff Scott Soto was looking for new musicians, because this is right at the end of his Yngwie tenure. So he sent that demo tape out. Jeff said, I'm really not into you as a bass player, but who played guitar on it? So I'm sitting home with my mom and phone rings. And at this time, I mean, to put it in context, I mean, Yngwie was the biggest thing in guitar.
Right.
I mean, it was him and Eddie Van Halen and Randy Rhoads. It was like that was as big as it could be. So to me, Jeff Scott Soto was like saying Ronnie James Dio's on the phone for you.
Right.
You know, and it was him. And I flew out to LA and we worked for a couple weeks on some stuff. And then a few months later, he called me up and said, hey, do you want to come to Sweden and do this tour with Marcel Jacob, who was the bass player in Rising Force.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those guys from those records, obviously without Yngwie. And so I spent probably, you know, collectively like 6 months, 8 months touring all over Scandinavia
at
with
17,
them.
18 years old.
Yeah.
And wow. Getting so cool.
And learning how to drink beer for the first time and having no bills on earth. It was just the greatest possible.
Did you get a lot of Scandinavian sniz?
Is that a Jeff, you mean? Did I tag Jeff? Is that what you're asking me?
So
I mean, he is a Viking after all.
It's true. So you got a bunch of really cool. I'm going to name some of the people that are on here that impressed me. Devin Townsend on there, Butch Walker, Todd Latour, not singing, playing drums, Bumblefoot, Pat Badger from Extreme, and then David Ellefson, who I love. I literally was on the phone with him yesterday, and I had to call him again today for a reason I'm not getting into today. But I spent an hour with him on the phone yesterday, convincing him to do something. And then I had to call him today to say, I changed my mind, can't do it. So I felt so stupid, but one of the coolest guys in rock and roll for sure.
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did these collabs come to be?
I mean, I've known all these guys. So first and foremost, it wasn't like a desperate plea to get like just anybody with a name on the record. I mean, I've known all these guys in one way or another, some much longer than others, but they were all social first. So when this idea of doing the record came up in like January, I was going to start it in March. I figured the cool thing to do would be I'll ask like 25, 30 of my friends, knowing that just because of life, tours, other records, things, you know, four or five guys will say yes, and that'll be awesome. And it turned out everybody said yes.
Nobody said no.
Nobody said no. Even to the point where like I was even going to do stuff with Corey Taylor, which he was finishing stuff, so we didn't have time to finish it right now. But there's so many more people that I didn't get around to just doing on this particular run of it. But
did it almost go to like being overwhelmed as opposed to thinking like, well, I'll do a few of these, but now I have everybody?
It was, you know, I'm such a fan of these guys. I mean, in all different ways. I mean, it's like seriously, like, you know, it sounds stupid because like, you have so many guests on the record. How could you be? But I really am a fan of what all these guys do. So it was exciting in that sense. And I just like to think that it's not because of the pandemic and they were bored. It's because of my singular genius that they decided to.
Can we go with half a dozen of one, Jason? Is that possible?
But it was awesome, man. I mean, you know, they're, you know, everybody from Clay. I mean, I think I'm most proud of the fact that if you look at like a guy like Clay Cook, who plays in the Zac Brown Band, and he actually co-wrote John Mayer's first solo record together. That's where that school comes from. Then you have a guy like Kevin Scott, who plays at like Bar 55 with Wayne Krantz and, you know, plays with Jimmy Herring and just was the bass player for John McLaughlin on the whole last tour. And then you have Devin Townsend. And we built this kind of ecosystem where all these different musicians that you wouldn't normally think, because who cares about people just having a guest on a record? That's not like any new ground, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's nice and you might like, oh, cool, but to have all these different guys and Butch Walker and all, you know, everybody's so different, but they did such amazing
stuff.
And
you created kind of like mini bands for each track. Is that a good way to look at it?
I mean, I wrote all the songs and I'm telling you, man, I couldn't accidentally do it again. I was like literally writing it. And I was like, you know, I'll throw this to Devin and see if Butch wants to do this. And then all of a sudden everything started coming back and falling into place where it just worked. Like it wasn't like I should have been professional and had a grid and looked at like Devin has this kind of tonality and it would be brilliant. I just literally like Devin was going to play bass on one track. And then he was like, Bumblefoot was like, well, I want to put the solo. And Devin's like, all right, well, I'll do the solo on this. And it was like, everyone was just so no ego at all. And it was just amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's going to sound really terrible because I'm sure you're not into the how happy Jason is about his new record.
Yeah. Well, when you do that and you work with somebody else, do you kind of let them put their spin on it? Like you said, if there's no ego, you're playing together, or is it kind of like your baby and they go along with you?
I think the song context was already done in the sense of that. But I mean, who am I? I want David Ellefson to do David Ellefson on the, what's the point of having him and then telling him what to do? And I think the advantage of this was kind of that no one was around anybody. Everyone was in their own home studios. So there was a real, you know, I've been around so many recordings and studios and bands where like a guy's trying to come up with a part and then the engineer just like his eyebrow goes slightly like, and the whole vibe shot and the guy doesn't ever execute what he really wanted to do because now he's bummed. And
so
everyone was able to do this by themselves, fully realize what they wanted to do and then send it.
You never sent anything back? Like, hey, can you redo this a little bit? Like whatever they sent you, like that just works for me.
It's like sports. I mean, when you pick A-level players, you tend to get A-level results.
Yeah, you're trusting in your talents, which I think is great.
And I mean, these guys are not, this is not like Butch Walker's first walk in the park. I mean, he just got done producing the Green Day record. The guy knows how to make records.
Yeah, David really Ellison. By the way, I think he is like, most people don't know Butch Walker. He came up recently on the show for another reason. I forget why, but he is such a production god to people that are in the know. The amount of records he's done and the range of records he's done. And forget about the fact that his own solo records are great. Marvelous 3, I loved South Gang. You know, he doesn't get the credit he deserves, I feel, except in his hometown where he's a superstar.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, you know, like I said, he's a monster. I mean, he's done everything from Pink to Green Day and everything in between.
It's crazy. If you look at the list, whoever's listening, just go to Wikipedia and look at the fucking records that he produced. It's batshit crazy how many hits. How many hit records he produced.
And I'm sure it's a personal highlight for him to be involved with this record. So
I'm sure because he knows you're genius.
I definitely
see what... My singular genius, please.
I definitely can tell why you were more into porno for Pyros or Jane's Addiction is because, like, this... The idea of the ego behind a lot of the hair metal, the way you kind of knock yourself down a little bit, I just don't think it would have worked for you. I like that, though. There's a more humbling quality to that music than there ever was to that 80s kind of poppy.
You know, the way I look at it stuff. Is like every genre has its peak, and then it's shortly followed by the world wanting to boil them alive in a vat of their own urine.
Oh, God, yeah.
So, you know, it happened to hair metal, but then I think time goes on and everyone's like, no, definitely. Leopard's amazing, and Bon Jovi's got great songs, and
yeah, just, it comes back, right?
And new metal, you know, you look at the bands, and you know, obviously Limp Bizkit's being torn apart or has been torn apart, and over time you're going to go like, no, Korn's amazing. That's a great band, you know. So I think for me, I've always been into music. So I was never about like, hey, I want to go to the mall and have some 14-year-old scream. I mean,
right?
It's fine.
I have 14-year-old scream, but for an entirely different reason. I don't want to get into
you. Corners them in
go to the mail and stuff, but that's not
sure.
So I mean. I always focus on the music. So, you know, sometimes, you know, if you're lucky enough to be in the business as long as I've been in the biz, you know, you're going to have moments where you're doing cool stuff and everyone's on your side, and you're going to shortly there be followed by a series of repetitive groin kicks. And if you can tolerate that long enough and keep doing what you do, hopefully people come around. And
I was trying to think while you said it, by the way, because yes, there was a big backlash for hair metal. I don't know if grunge ever got a negative stamp. You know what I mean? Like grunge turned into new metal, turned into whatever, but it was never looked at like, oh my God, Alice in Chains. Ugh. I don't know if that ever happened.
Well, I think they kind of gave themselves a negative stamp when you think about it with the various suicides and
ODs. Yeah, they all kind of self-imploded, I guess. Maybe
when you think about it. And I mean,
the bands were great. You know, Chris Cornell, Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, all those bands are amazing. But I mean, if you wanted to get into poking fun of fashion, I mean, you know, I mean, how cool is it wearing combat boots and bike shorts and flannel?
Billy is
wearing spandex and no shirt. I mean, in a different way. At the end of the day, all that stuff comes and goes. And it's, you know, Chris Cornell is a legend because he's a great singer. And timeless.
Yeah. And God damn it. He was cool as shit. He was probably the coolest front man, I think, in my lifetime in terms of maintained it his whole life, where being idiotically good looking, incredibly talented, and his voice never wavered.
It's a burden I share with him.
I'm sure, yeah, especially with those tattoos of yours. By the way, the two songs that I heard that jumped out at me right away on the first listen was the lead-off track, Bring Your Dead, of course, the single with Latour, but also Alone in the World is a great song also with Jeff. It is great stuff. You touched on it a little bit. I love that you actually never had a regular job. You have been a working musician since you're 18. That is fucking rare. I don't know how many people could say that.
And wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like whilst I am acutely aware of the fact that I am not mentioned in the great names of the Stones and Zeppelin and U2s, it's still rarefied air to get to do what you want to do every day and create music and have made a, you know, lovely life for myself and my family. You know, I don't think my kids still have a clue as to what the hell I do. I mean, Dad just goes in the studio and makes strange music and whatever.
And that's impressive, by the way. I looked at your breadth of music, the amount of music that you put out between, what is that thing, owl stretching? Is that the right term? And then solo singles like The Depths and One Step Closer. I mean, you are just putting out music. That's just, it's in you.
Well, that part, the interesting thing was I had run a label for a long time with my brother, and we had a lot of successful bands on that, fortunately, like Nonpoint and Skindred and Sixth and Uncle and all these really cool bands. I'd gotten so burned out on like managers, radio, trying to be commercial, retail, all that stuff. I said, you know, I just want to write, just do a writing exercise. So I set it up a little challenge for myself where I was going to write, record, release a song in about 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured I'd use Bandcamp because it's instant. Like I could finish a song, hit upload, and just, you know, I just wanted to write. I didn't want to get like the snare reverb right and spend 3 weeks like, you know, doing that. So I wound up releasing like 150 songs over a year and a half.
Well, it should be 150 days if it was 24 hours to write a song.
and then that kind of took on a life of its own, which was kind of neat. So,
yeah, that's pretty cool. And I watched you do, but boy, was it over my fucking head. But you did a guitar exchange talk where you kind of like showed that where you don't live in the details, just kind of play, like don't get it caught up on which chord to play in and all these other stuff. It just kind of, no one remembers the solo more than they remember the song. You just want it to be a good song.
Yeah, I've always been a song. I mean, I think we're all song people. I mean, it's amazing when you can marry the two and you have like Comfortably Numb and that solo. Mm-hmm. I mean, but you know, I'm not a massive fan of watching, you know, people wheedle on at light speed on YouTube. Not that it's not great. And if it makes them happy, that's amazing. But if you're in that game, there's a 3-year-old in Guam doing it 4 times faster. So
right, that's true.
It's gonna be very difficult to actually carve out a life doing minute long shred fests.
The one guy I could say that always impressed me on his talent as far as technical player and just an incredible guitarist, besides you, obviously.
Thank you.
Is Bumblefoot. Bumblefoot, to me, technically, may be one of the best guitarists I've ever seen.
Let me explain to you how insanely talented that guy is. We had met. Jeff and I were doing these solo acoustic shows, which was really designed for me to try to break into comedy because I figured I could do jokes. And when they sucked, I could play a song that someone wanted to hear. And it would kind of get me out of trouble before the crowd revolted and started throwing furniture. So we were doing this and we were going to New York and we said, hey, Bumblefoot, you know, why don't you come play a song with us? He's like, sure. He comes up and we have 2-hour long sets at a sold out Rockwood Music Hall thing. Mm-hmm. He comes up during the first song, has no idea any of the history, Saigon Kick, doesn't know a thing we're doing, and plays the entire 2 sets, note for note, including singing vocals, to songs he had never heard until I was playing them.
That's like, crazy.
He just followed your lead?
He just knew, like, he's just...
Wow.
Not to mention that, like, if you go to him, like, okay, I Love Lucy, in the pilot episode, the key grip's mother wrote a jingle for like, you know, Spam. He'll know it.
He really is, man. Wow. You should also, by the way, if you're a fan of guitar, he put up these like instructional videos a few years ago where he says how to sound like each different guitarist. And they run the gamut of like crazy. And he just explains it in a very almost autistic way, but then nails every guitarist where you would think it's that guitar is playing. It's really amazing.
Yeah, he's like brilliant, obviously, but I mean, he's got that whatever that Rain Man card counting thing is.
Yeah,
he has that with music. It's just unbelievable. Really,
and also, couldn't be a nicer guy. Just a fucking great dude.
Been like that? You worked with at least in that sense where they, you know, you went up and just started playing. Like most blown away by, and it, not to take anything else from anybody else you've worked with, but just. I guess you started at 17, I imagine, or 18. Everything has been sort of icing on the cake since you were asked to tour. But what was like your moment where you were just shocked you were working with someone?
I mean, it's a little bit of a Lion King-esque story, but the first concert I went and saw was Ozzy Osbourne. So it's the Blizzard of Oz. It's Randy Rhoads, Rudy Zarzo, and Tommy Aldridge. And Def Leppard opened up on the High and Dry record. So I saw Randy Rhoads, and it was just like, as a young kid, I don't know how I was 8, 9, 10, whatever it was. I was just like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. That's the greatest guitar player I've ever seen. And years later, Saigon Kick got to go to Japan and open for Ozzy at the Budokan.
Oh, wow.
And not to mention like Cheap Trick Live at Budokan, just is a towering record over my childhood. So we're playing the Budokan. I become friends with Zach because we were there for like a week to do the 2 shows. And Zach's like, dude, come up and like sit behind my amps on the No More Tears tour. You know, like, so. And so I'm sitting behind Zach's amp and I'm looking out into the crowd to where I was sitting as a little kid. And I'm like, I'm on stage having just opened for Ozzy, sitting behind the guitar player's rig. It was like, I literally felt like, you know, James Earl Jones was going to have to come out and hold me in front of the crowd, you know, and start singing some kind of it was unbelievable.
Right.
I was like, there's no way this is actually happening.
Just like a movie. Great. Yeah, just say all full circle justifies everything you've done. That's so cool.
And watching you do those guitar exchange truck, you're obviously such a fan of just music in general. All thing, it's not, I always see that one, not always, once in a while you see that where you can just tell the person that's talking, you're just so passionate about music, regardless of what genre it is. I've always said there's only 2 kinds of music, good and bad, and I can find something I like in every genre. Speaking of which, before we get to the last questions and wrap this up, rumor has it you're going to play a song.
Oh, I don't have my guitar. I sent it out to be.
I only got my electrics there for decoration.
I can't play acoustic.
And don't play I Love You, because I might start thinking about my ex-girlfriend and cry on the camera.
Well, I was gonna
Can you play I Love You?
I was going to do something from the new record until I realized there's nothing on it that translates really well acoustically.
Yeah, I actually listened to the new record today thinking, what would you play acoustically? And really, none of them really work.
And then I thought starting it off with a song called Very Fine People, where it was fun while it lasted for the Nazis and fascists, might not set the tone appropriately for the show. So I figured I'll just do a little bit of The Lizard, because... Is that cool?
Shannon, should I mute ourselves, or you're going to mute us, Shannon?
You can, so then you can unmute yourselves right after.
I'm going to mute
And you like... can mute me if you want as well, because I don't know how this is going to go. Well, I tell you people and do the lizard. Pull yourself together and take a lesson. Take my flask and sip the liquid. Forgive me now for what I might deliver. They start to quiver. I ask myself if to give is richer.
Awesome.
Sorry, that was awesome.
It's seriously awesome.
Oh, really great stuff.
This is awesome.
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
You seem like an upbeat, fun guy. Come Take Me Now is the most depressing song of all time. Did you write that one?
I did.
What was the motivation of that?
Well, what I think is, like, I've always written some, to some degree, certain aspects of it have been, you know, unbelievably syrupy and sappy. Mm-hmm. And I'm a pretty demented person. Which really, the question is, then how screwed up is Barry Manilow?
Because all of his songs are so sappy and sweet.
They're brilliantly set. So I think that's really the joke. I think if you're like Love Is On The Way and Come, they are so heavy that they've collapsed upon themselves and no heaviness can come out. So they appear to be ballads.
The black holes.
It's a black hole of hate. And all that can squeak out is just this little bit of romanticism.
It's funny because it really is. I've often used that as an example as one of the most depressing songs I've ever. I love that song, but it's such a depressing song. Come Take Me Now. It's crazy.
Not to bring up something, but it which brings up the greatest like screw up socially I've had ever. So I finally meet at some point. I meet Eddie Trunk. Eddie Trunk, killer. I just want to tell you something. A song you wrote. Come Take Me Now. I'm telling you right now, dead serious, it has to be played at my funeral. And I go, well, I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, the weird thing is that it seems after the fact, if it's played at your funeral, if it's when he's on his deathbed, it would make more sense. Oh, I just
it takes a lot of pressure off the performer, though.
Yeah, I just remembered this crazy story.
It's just for him.
Tell me if this is true. So we're going back to when the rest of the guys were in the band. Mm-hmm. Right. they told the story that just got into my head. You guys were on tour and you used to play a game with each other. And maybe this is totally bullshit, but it's what they told us, where you pulled down your pants, where you farted in each other's faces on the bus. And he said that Matt or you, one or the other, decided to pull down their pants and fart in the other one's face for the first time and didn't realize you had diarrhea and you left an outline of the person on the window of the tour bus.
This is a loosely translated story. This did not happen to, this involved Matt and our drum tech.
Okay. So it's not far off though.
No, it happened 100%. Matt, I don't want to start talking about him and his life because it'll be perceived as just another hate attack from me. But I'm sure he'd be happy to illustrate the ins and outs of that. But I will say that it is 100% true.
Okay, that's funny. It literally just came to me. I remember that story. It's 20 years ago I heard that story, but it felt like repeating it. And then the last couple things.
Of pink eye.
Yeah, pink eye, Jesus Christ. one of the other things I read that was fascinating, if it's true, you were taught English by Ace Frehley's cousin in the hopes of meeting Ace Frehley.
Well, I went to the high school I was attending. Rumor was his like third cousin was the English teacher.
Okay,
so it was really the only reason I decided to even remotely attend, because at that age you figure like I'll meet Ace Frehley's third cousin and that's how I break into show business.
Right.
You have no other how it really works. So that was my thought process, which explains a lot about how my career has gone.
I just bought my kid his first guitar because he loves Kiss, actually. And I got him a Randy Rhoads Jackson short scale because he's five.
Oh, awesome.
Do you have any particular advice for him, like that I can give to a young guy? I mean, he loves it. Like I said, he's five. He's almost six. He just plays it by himself, learning it, the feel of it right now because he just got it for Christmas. But would you suggest like lessons or online stuff, or what do you think?
I mean, there's some amazing stuff online. Obviously, there's a billion different kind of courses. I mean, lessons if he wants it. But I mean, all the musicians I know that have gone on to a high level did exactly that. They just love playing. So they would be like, as a kid, which will lead into our next section of the questions, they're going to be very boring because they all involve me sitting in my room by myself for 12 hours playing guitar. but that's what I wanted to do. And I think that because at a young age, I felt like some people were good at sports or math or other things. Like I felt like this was something I could do.
Sure.
And it just fed this kind of cycle of like, I'm getting better at this and maybe everybody else can do this. And you just get into that kind of cycle of more and more and more and more and more.
So, by the way, the new album, again, Baron Von Belsky Orchestra, is the title of the full Jason Bieler and the Baron Von Belsky Orchestra. Songs from the Apocalypse, Songs for the Apocalypse is out now. The reviews have been great in varied sources, not just like 80s rock magazines saying, look what Jason Bieler's up to, like new progressive rock, probably people that don't even know your history are fans of this record right now.
It's amazing, man. I got put on these new big Spotify prog metal lists and, all these different things where people are like, to them, Saigon Kick is irrelevant. They don't even know what it is. So half the crowd that's been with me the whole time, that's amazing. And I'm always thrilled that they've stuck with me through thick and thin. And then it's this whole new group of people are discovering it. And yeah, I mean, look, whatever blowing up means at the moment, I mean, it doesn't mean what it used to mean years ago, but the records in the right, it feels good. And a lot of people are responding really positively. And, I'm sure that'll be shortly followed by some kind of horrible wave of negativity, but it's awesome. At this point in my life, I never would have thought I'd be making a record with all my buds and then having it this well received is super cool.
Awesome. All right, Shannon, let's do this. Let's hit the first.
The first time ever I saw concert Detroit's had sex.
As you know, the name of the show is Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, the SDR show. We always wrap by asking our guests their first experience with all three. First time they had sex, first drug they ever did. We already know the answer to your first concert because you just said it a little while ago. That's fine. I'll allow it, Jason. I'll allow it.
I think I do that. I accidentally ask those questions when I'm on your show because I'm just so curious.
Yeah, it's fine. So the Ozzy show was your first, Ozzy Def Leppard.
It's a hell of a good show.
And you were a kid, you said. You were in your single digits.
Well, let me rephrase this. My first rock metal thing that I saw was Ozzy at the Blizzard of Oz store. I may have been in attendance to a Donnie and Marie show.
Oh, awesome.
Where I was actually touched on the hand by Marie, which may lead into your next question.
Well, let me say this. I actually met Marie when I was about 8. My mother took me to Disney World in Florida. Disney World, right? And Disneyland's in L.A. or Disney World in L.A.? Disneyland is in L.A.
Land is L.A.
World is Florida, yeah.
Disneyland I went to. And I don't know, this is going to date. I don't think Shannon's going to know this, but we're all about the same age, I think. Do you remember?
Same age as Shannon.
Exactly the same age.
To the day.
Yep.
Are you two of the same age? Exactly.
Same birthday, right. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. So me and Jason,
I look terrible.
Do you remember Waylon Flowers and Madam?
Yes.
Okay, so my mom was very good friends with Waylon Flowers, so we got invited to a show that he was on with Marie Osmond, and at 8 years old, we got to meet and hang out with Marie Osmond when I was 8 years old, which is hilarious. Anyway, just because you brought that up. So now, the first time you did a drug, ideally after pot, unless pot's the worst drug you ever did.
I was not really a drug guy, which is horribly boring. I may have done a little too much NyQuil at one point. I think there is a time, and when I was a kid, I was in the social group of some people. So I may have had orange juice with someone might have put some kind of mushrooms in it.
Okay.
Possibly, but one
voodoo juice.
So I'm not sure if that's even accurate. I was not found later that evening running nude down, a major highway while eating my wrist. So I can't really say that happened.
Yeah, so in general, you're sober, you drink.
You didn't bite off someone's face on the 101.
I drink all the time. So beer, wine, I'm not even anti-drug. It's just I'm willing to do it if we want to get together later and try some stuff.
By the way, I've told the story so many times on the show, but we have a few people coming in for this. So maybe you'll be one of them. Once a year, I try a drug. I've never done any drugs, and I try a drug on the show once a year. We have a few rock stars coming in next time the world opens up to all try a drug together. I'll be trying it. They've all done it already. You're more than welcome to come into that episode if you want to be crazy. I did it at 50. I did cocaine for the first time in my life.
And how did that turn out?
Not well.
He's on it still. It's been a crippling addiction since the day he did that.
If there's any truth to that, we'll let you know afterwards if you want to come join us and try a drug at one point.
I'd like a full report if you don't mind, though.
Yeah, I'm in recovery. I love drugs, so I'm the opposite. I just can't do them anymore. Yeah, it's sad. I will come to watch Ralph try a new drug anytime.
We haven't decided what that drug is yet, but we have who's coming in? Jelly Roll's coming in. And
Jelly Roll's coming in. The dude from,
Hollywood Undead.
Hollywood Undead, yeah. Johnny Three Tears, yeah.
I just feel like I'd be the worst possible. I'd be like, are you guys going to do the pot?
Yes.
That's me, dude. It's me. I don't know what we're going to do. We have to figure out what that drug. I mean, we have time because it's going to be a while before the world is open. But once
have you done peyote? Do they still? Well, yeah, they would still have it.
I've seen Wile E. Coyote, which is nothing to do with that.
But they rhyme. So you're going to write.
That's my drug reference right there.
Yeah. All right. Now, the first time you had sex.
Can this include manual stimulation?
No, but we have to say this. It has to conclude because sometimes we have porn stars on consensual sex.
Well, that would
be. Oh, wow.
Yes. I've never had non-consensual sex.
I know.
Yeah, I really wouldn't even know how to answer that question. Most of the most meaningful moments I had were solo in my youth.
Fair enough.
Were you raised Catholic? So it was shameful enough to be considered sex? Okay. Oh, all right.
Half Catholic, half Jewish.
So the level of guilt is actually amplified.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's gotta be rough.
I knew touching myself was wrong on so many levels.
Sure, that's two different religions that think you're terrible.
The church would never approve Norton.
Where did the S come from in cashew?
Syrian.
This is why I'm not a professional comedian. I'm trying.
Fair enough. The one I like is that if black and Jewish is bluish, that makes sense to me. But Cash, you have an extra letter in there. That's all.
It's just Sammy Davis Jr. It's the only person, really.
So You're just dream crushing is what you're doing.
Yeah, I've been doing that's been my theme the whole fucking show. All right, so again, the new album is out now, Songs for the Apocalypse by Jason Bieler and the Baron von Bielski Orchestra. Shit ton of cool collaborations on there as well. I listened through the whole thing full time, and then I told you the tracks that jumped out at me. Really big on it. Following you everywhere at Jason Bieler. Anything else you want to plug before we go around and do the rest of the plugs?
No, man. I just super appreciate you having me on, and I hope you two have now grown to have a deep hate for me, and I can look forward to following all the negative stuff that will transpire post this.
Well, I'm going to be buying the album and giving it a very positive review.
I like that. Thank you very much.
Look at Dave Landau coming to the table. Let's hear your plugs, Dave.
DaveLandau.com. You can check out my tour dates coming up by clicking tour, and I have some new merchandise in the store that's all masks with pandas on them and just dumb shit. So if you want anything ridiculous, just go there.
And then obviously your two shows on Compound Media.
The Anthony Cumia Show with Dave Landau and A Fair One with Tommy Pope, which Ralph will be on very soon.
Yeah, I'm excited to come back on. I enjoyed it last time very much. All right, Shannon, your plugs?
Follow me on Instagram at ShannonLee6982 and listen to my podcast, The Thing Is Ding. We talk about bad dates, fighting, and ghosts.
I like to always look at people when they when she says ghosts to see if I could guess if the person believes in ghosts. And I'm going to say Jason does not believe in ghosts.
You are correct, sir.
How? Saw it in your
but
eyes.
I don't mean that I don't respect people. Well, I do respect that people can believe what they want to believe.
I thought you could say don't respect ghosts. That would have been funnier.
Yeah, like I believe in them. I just don't care for them.
I believe in them, but then doesn't respect.
I believe in them, but I have no respect for them whatsoever.
It's like just go pick a place and go.
You think I'm mean to ex band members? I taunt like the dead spirits, like ridiculous. I make such fun of them. Like, this is what became of you.
Look at you. Look at you, sad sack of nothing.
Of all the places to haunt, you pick me? What the hell?
Follow me over at I Am Ralph Sutton. My other health and wellness show that I do with the founder of Juice Press is called The Good Sugar Podcast. And, dude, honestly, it's a pleasure. I take back all the negative things I've thought about you for the last 25 years.
Thank you very much. I feel like there's a redeeming moment in my life.
Yeah, it's been therapy for all of us.
Really, I feel good about this.
All right,
it's great meeting you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much again.
We know we end the show every week with a song of the week. My favorite was Alone in the World, but if there's one you want to hear that you want us to add to the playlist other than that, by all means.
See how he phrased that? He sets it up so I say something different and then he can go afterwards. What a dick. Like, I set him up the song I really liked and now he's going to pick something. See, I...
Please pick I Love You.
Exactly.
Just to make him cry.
If Vanessa's listening, by the way, you broke my heart, you bitch.
She's not.
Someday I can tell you how that song made us the Led Zeppelin of Indonesia, but that's for another time.
Oh, was that a big hit in Indonesia? Really?
It was so Spinal Tap. Like, the band had crashed and burned and everything had fallen apart. And I get a call like 6 months later, like, you guys, you have like the number one record in Indonesia. I'm like, first of all, I couldn't even figure out where Indonesia was. Like, where? But it was true. We wound up doing nearly a stadium tour in Indonesia.
Wow, they did that. There was a movie called Searching for Sugar Man.
Yeah,
that
Detroit
kind of
guy. Where? Yeah.
I saw that. It was very similar to that, except Indonesian.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Nedzi was just living in squalor in Detroit, and I'd seen him at record stores before, and I had no idea who he was until I saw that documentary.
Oh, really? Wow,
yeah,
that's fascinating. I got to see him live. He did one show in New York City right after the movie came out. I got to see the show, but he was really frail. Like, he had to be walked to the stage and, you know, really, really frail, but really great albums that he put out. Really good albums.
Yeah. Just imagine getting a call when he, like, somebody left your CD here on accident and you're the biggest thing in this country. Yeah,
it's really great. It was a great, if no one's ever seen that doc, Searching for Sugar Man, another great music doc, I could not recommend enough.
Yeah, really good.
So we'll do, my pick. And thank you so much, dude, for being a part of the show. It was a blast. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Shannon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ani, and all the listeners. By the way, we ended January, which this I think comes out next week, but we ended January with the most listens we've ever had in a month in the 5 years of doing the show. So thank you to everybody that's been supporting the show, and we'll see you next week on the STR show.
listening to the SDR Show.